Please be seated. The second case for oral argument this morning is Johnny Wiff Appellant versus Hooterville Hutterian Brethren, Inc., George Waldner, Sr., Kenneth Waldner, Samuel Waldner, and Thomas Waldner, Appellees. This case was originally set on the non-oral docket for last fall, and then was carried over to because we deemed it important enough that it merited oral argument, and that brought it into this year. Justice Konenkamp retired December 31st, but Justice Wilbur had to disqualify herself, so we then brought Justice Konenkamp back to sit in Justice Wilbur's place. And I believe there was one other delay because of a request to counsel for a family event, which brings it to the day for oral argument. For the appellant, we have Mr. Ed Evans, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. David Bradley Olson, an attorney from Minneapolis, and Mr. A.J. Swanson, an attorney from Canton. Mr. Olson, I understand you'll be presenting this morning?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, very well. With that, then, Mr. Evans, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, I appear on behalf of the appellant and third-party defendant, Johnny Wiff, Sr. From our perspective, this case is very simple. I know you've been there before. We are not here for one reason and one reason only. We believe the trial court should have simply dismissed the case, saying there was no subject matter jurisdiction to hear it, and that would be a dismissal and the end of it. But unfortunately, the trial court dismissed the third-party complaint brought by the Waldner faction, or Group 1, against Wiff, a member of Group 2, first noting that the trial court lapsed subject matter jurisdiction over religious controversy, as this court has decided on at least three previous occasions involving these particular parties. But then the court entered findings of fact and conclusions of law that were proposed by Mr. Olson that addressed the merits of the controversy. We're not here seeking to readdress the issue of subject matter jurisdiction already settled by this court in its previous holdings. We accept those decisions. At the hearing at the trial court level, on our motion, on the Wiff motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, the trial court first acknowledged this court's prior opinions, held there was a constitutional, or noted there was a constitutional prohibition against judicial involvement in religious controversy such as this one. Mr. Olson agreed, saying it was their position had already been decided, said that on the record, but then submitted findings of fact and conclusions of law to the trial court after that hearing that found the warranty deeds in the name of Wiff as trustee for the members of Hutterville were invalid and unenforceable. Those deeds were based on previous actions by the Board of Directors of Hutterville electing Wiff not only president but also trustee, and a resolution resolving that the land would be transferred him to hold legal title to as trustee. This court said we aren't going to get into that, has said it three times. And by entering those conclusions of law, declaring the deeds to be invalid, the trial court, we believe, improperly addressed the merits of the controversy in violation of this court's prior mandates. I don't need to address the lengthy, unfortunate course of events of this dispute that brings us here. You've heard that before. But I do want to touch on it because it is pertinent to the issue before the court here today. In Hutterville 1, decided by this court in 2010, the Wiff Group brought an action seeking determination of who are the true identities and officers. In good faith, said there's a dispute. We want to know who they are. Judge Von Wald initially ruled in favor of the WHIF group, finding that he and his followers were the proper officers and directors. That's the only court that's ever addressed that. Said they're the proper officers and directors. After that, the Waldner faction purportedly excommunicated several of the WHIF group members, including WHIF. Judge Von Wald said, okay, now it's turned into a religious controversy and I can't get involved. Before that, the officers and directors Judge Von Wald had found were the WHIF group. This court upheld Judge Von Wald, of course. Justice Zinner, that on that occasion, in a unanimous opinion, held, quote, we conclude the underlying religious controversies over church leadership and the validity of member excommunications so pervades the governance issue that it's beyond the jurisdiction of secular courts, unquote marks. Hutterville II decided 2 years later in 2012. In that case, it was alleged the members of Hutterville were deadlocked, in limbo, deadlocked over the management and control of the corporate affairs, and requested a dissolution. After trial, the trial court held the Waldner's faction was oppressive, depriving Group 2, the WHIF group, of fuel and fire equipment, refusing to pay medical bills or to provide clothing to Group 2 members, thereby violating the corporate purpose of communal living, the purpose of the existence of the corporation, and ordered the thing dissolved. As noted in our reply brief, that oppressive conduct continues and has gotten worse, including efforts to deprive Group 2, the WHIF group, and the women and children that are associated with that group of food, garden space, use of colony buildings, dining, work, school for the children, a place to worship, health care, and even cutting off running water and electricity, as a result of which there's felony charges pending in Brown County today against members of that group. In the end, in Hutterville II, this court, this time by Justice Cohenkamp, unanimously held the underlying religious controversies over leadership so pervade it that dissolution is beyond the secular court's jurisdiction. Hutterville III, action was a little different and involved approving Harvey Jewett's actions in accounting when he was appointed a receiver. But this court reaffirmed its holdings in Hutterville I and II, and in doing so noted that the Waldner's group continued insistence on the one hand that the trial court could not act, and at the same time demanding that the Supreme Court or the trial court to act in its favor. Justice Cohenkamp observes, quote, highlights the paradoxical positions taken by the Waldner group, end quote marks. Simply stated, the Waldner group wants this court to act in its favor and at the same time not address any other issues raised by the other side, citing the First Amendment applies, but apparently it only applies to when our side raises issues and not them. Two other quick opinions that I'll mention. Decker versus Cheddar, the Cheddar Cutterite Brethren, 1999, this time by Chief Justice Gilbertson, writing a majority opinion, and after thoroughly reviewing the history of the Cutterite religion, even quoting scripture, adopted the federal district court's analysis in Woman, holding quote marks, and I think this is poignant, quote marks, the court is unable to envision any set of facts which would more entangle the court in matters of religious doctrine and practice. The religious communal system presented in this case involves more than matters of religious faith and involves a religious lifestyle. Any ellipsis, any resolution of a property dispute, which is what we have here today, a property dispute, the title holder of the land and the deeds. Any resolution of a property dispute between a colony and its members would require extensive inquiry into religious doctrine and beliefs. It would be a gross violation Justice Gilbertson's highlighting night mine of the First Amendment and the Supreme Court mandates for this court to become involved in this dispute. One last case I'll mention, the RICO lawsuit brought by them against Jeff Sten, Harvey Jewett, Siegel Barnett Law Firm, and others. The Eighth Circuit, holding that the Waldner Group's attempt to relitigate the issue of membership, officers, and directors in Hunterville was barred by the doctrine of judicial estoppel, the Eighth Circuit stated, and I quote, having twice succeeded in foreclosing judicial determination and recognition of the proper officers and directors of Hunterville, the Waldners bring this federal action questioning the legitimacy of the WIF faction's claims to Hunterville in asserting the legitimacy of their own offices. We will not permit the Waldners now to claim the religious questions are a sham when these issues have been resolved all along. Nor will we permit the Waldners the opportunity to prove that they are, in fact, Hunterville officers and directors or were unlawfully removed. If you look at the Waldners' filings, both at the federal district court level and the Eighth Circuit level, they make the exact same arguments they make in their brief to this court. In this court, they devote some 25 pages or more as to trying to say that this court does have subject matter jurisdiction. The Eighth Circuit said that issue's already been decided by the South Dakota Supreme Court correctly twice. We're not going to let you flip-flop and try to use this forum to reverse what you argued to the South Dakota Supreme Court previously. And they said it in rather strong language. The other arguments they raise very quickly, first they say that my client WIF is not an aggrieved party and has no standing for an appeal. What is an aggrieved party? This court has said that an aggrieved party means, is the ruling somehow prejudicial to you? Are you being prejudiced, harmed? As noted in our brief, the Waldner Group has already filed the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law with the Register of Deeds, saying that the former deeds are invalid. They've used the court's rulings to attempt to illegally merge Hunterville into a new corporation in Minnesota. What connection does Hunterville have to Minnesota? Its sole assets, 10,000 acres of farmland, and the equipment necessary to farm that land, and its all of its residences are in South Dakota. What is going on other than the lawyers are from Minnesota? Think about it. Why are they incorporating in Minnesota? By declaring those WIF deeds not valid and unenforceable, by findings of fact proposed by them, if allowed to stand, that's binding, collateral estoppel, res judicata in the future, that those deeds are invalid. If the Hunterville church hierarchy, if the Hutterite church hierarchy ever did decide to try to resolve this issue, which is where the resolution belongs, as this court has noted, we have findings of fact and conclusions of law that could interfere with their right to do so.
All right, Mr. Evans, what are you asking then for a remedy?
That's usually
the chief's question, I'm sorry.
Okay.
But what?
You've heard all this before.
But yeah,
the immediate remedy is this court should vacate the trial court's findings of fact and conclusions of law, as well as its supplemental order and opinion trying to explain it, and remand this case back to the trial court with instructions to simply dismiss it for lack of subject matter jurisdiction without any further findings or conclusions. That's what should be done.
Mr. Evans.
Yes.
There's one twist in this case that we haven't seen before, and that's the ecclesiastical deference doctrine. And it appears that depositions were taken after Honor Bill 2, which purport, at least according to the appellees, to change the situation here. What's your view on that issue?
I think this court reviewed the ecclesiastical doctrine, number one, and talked about it in its prior opinions, implicitly, if not explicitly, number one. Number two, so I think those issues were covered. Number two, to the extent that they want to offer testimony through a 2013 deposition, all that, it's not new evidence. It was all available.
But we
haven't, 2010.
We haven't seen it before, and it purports to say that a body has made a decision here.
Well, but a body hasn't made a decision, and we can get down into the merits of that. The 1992 schism that we keep referring to didn't change, there was no new church. Nobody left the Hutterite religion. All they said is, Reverend Kleinsasser, you're stepping aside for your personal abuse of mismanagement of church funds. We're electing a new leader. That's what happened there. And so as long as a new leader has been elected, how can you honor anything that Group 1 says that they've done under Reverend Kleinsasser when the entire church and the hierarchy has removed him and said, Hutterite Group 2, you are the real religion? It all goes back to the 1992 schism. And number three, if you look at what they filed with the Federal District Court and the Court of Appeals, affidavits by Attorney Sandvin, affidavits by Lehi Waldner, and go through all of this, and their briefs, they set out the exact same argument to them. This is new. This is different. And the Eighth Circuit said they have raised no new evidence that would allow us to be able to resolve this controversy. The exact same evidence was before Judge Pearsall in the Court of Appeals. Chief Judge Riley wrote, even with this new stuff, there is nothing new that would allow us to resolve this controversy, was what he said.
If the trial court in this case dismissed the case, what was the basis of the dismissal?
The basis of the dismissal at oral argument was the Supreme Court has said we should not get involved in this. Okay. And then said, but I don't see any way those deeds can be valid. And then entered findings and conclusions saying they were not valid and dismissed the case because the deeds were not valid.
So would the outcome then be controlled by our civil procedures code sections that define a dismissal? There are no findings of fact required.
That's right. I mean, in our position, there shouldn't have been, and we pointed that out to the trial court. We objected to the findings and conclusions and said, when you dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction, findings of fact and conclusions of law are not required. And they aren't. And I suppose if a court wants to and enter findings of fact saying this is a religious controversy, the court doesn't have jurisdiction to address it or something like that, or enter in a memorandum opinion, which would be in the more traditional approach, there'd be nothing wrong with that. But to enter findings of fact and conclusions of law on the merits, and to go back to Justice Zinner for a minute, you'll never convince me that the judge considered the merits of this case other than just kind of off the top of his head. I mean, I do think he was trying to be helpful. He's trying to say that this thing's a mess. You all have to agree, especially as a supplemental opinion. You all have to agree on anything. I think he's trying to help, as you all said in Hutterville 2, Justice Kohnkamp, you said the trial court's trying to do the right thing and order dissolution to make some sense of this, but can't under the law. And I think the same thing happened here to Judge Dodderpool, saying, you know, I'm going to tell them they all have to agree on everything. But unfortunately, not permissible under the law. And you'll never convince me that Judge Dodderpool heard the merits of the case, considered the highest hierarchy of the church, and made an evaluation of all of that in a 30-minute oral argument hearing on a motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. He just didn't do that. So for all those reasons, we believe that the trial court's opinion should be vacated, remanded, and unfortunately say that this is not a case that can be addressed or resolved by the secular courts.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Mr. Olson, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, David Bradley Olson, Minneapolis, Minnesota, on behalf of Hutterville Hutterian Brethren, Inc. and the Waldners. This court needs to decide today whether Johnny Wipf, having chosen to litigate this case through a proxy, Red Acre LLC, can now prosecute the appeal that his stand-in chose to drop. And if he can do that, whether civil courts are forever barred from considering the effect of his recent admissions in 2012 and 2013, that more than 7 years ago, the highest tribunal in Hutterville's church, to which then Johnny Wipf admittedly belonged, stripped him of all authority to act for Hutterville and never reinstated him. As to the first issue, it's our position that Mr. Wipf's appeal should be dismissed because he's not an aggrieved party with standing under precedent of this court, and even if he had standing, his appeal is moot. As to the second issue, if Mr. Wipf's appeal is not dismissed, it's our position that this court should affirm in part because Judge Dobberpool got it correct that he had jurisdiction to decide on the merits that the lease in question between Red Acre and Wipf is invalid, and it should reverse in part because entry of judgment divested the circuit court of any jurisdiction to later alter or amend it. The remedy at that point, if anybody was aggrieved, was an appeal, not an amended judgment. Mr. Wipf's not an aggrieved party with standing to appeal. In Jones versus Dappin, this court decided that when a judgment is entered in a defendant's favor, that person is not an aggrieved party. And in that opinion, this court expressly limited the exception to plaintiffs who are aggrieved because they prevail on perhaps one of two inconsistent theories. Mr. Wipf is not a plaintiff, never was. He was a third-party defendant. The claims against him were dismissed. Once they were dismissed, he cannot be an aggrieved party under this court's precedent. Even if Mr. Wipf could somehow be considered to be an aggrieved party, his appeal is nevertheless moot. In his reply brief at page 5, he says specifically he is not appealing the ruling of the validity of the lease, which means that the only issue that was raised by Red Acre in its complaint has been decided, and a dismissal of the third-party complaint against Mr. Wipf for lack of jurisdiction will not change that result. That's what he's asking this court to do today. Even though the claims against him have been dismissed, they want this court to remand back to the trial court to dismiss again for lack of jurisdiction. But that's not going to change any result, and it would serve no purpose, and again, under this court's
Then why did you file the findings with the Register of Deeds if it wouldn't make any difference?
It doesn't make any difference. That was just one part of the record, Your Honor. Whether those findings stay or they go doesn't make any difference as to all the post-judgment corporate activities that Hutterville did.
So are you agreeing the findings should and can be stricken?
That's
not appropriate.
We're agreeing that this entire appeal is moot and should be dismissed. We're not agreeing that the findings should be stricken.
So they do have value in your eyes to your clients.
The only portion of the findings that should not be stricken are Judge Dobberpool's findings on the merits that the lease itself is invalid.
Well, if you had a motion to dismiss, how could he make a finding on the merits without evidence?
We didn't have a motion to dismiss, and the judge did have volumes of evidence in front of him. We had affidavits, we had the entire history, we had transcripts of Johnny Wipf's deposition, which are quoted in the briefs that we filed with this court. And in those depositions, well, first, I should say at the hearing, when Judge Dobberpool came out on the bench, he said he's reviewed all of that material we submitted, which was voluminous, And he said, I really can't see that there's any dispute as to the facts here. And with that, we most certainly agree with Judge Dobberpool. He got that correct. There is no dispute as to the facts, because Johnny Whip admitted that in 2008, when he was a member of Hutterville's church, when he submitted to the authority of the hierarchy, he was called in front of a tribunal of 55 ministers who disciplined him and stripped him of authority. At that
point, was Group 1 ministers, correct?
He was a member of the Group 1 church at the time.
Well, now he says he's a member of Group 2.
Correct, and that's exactly the point we're making here today.
Arch tells me that I've got to figure out, if I'm going to enter into this as a secular jurist, which is the true church, Group 1 or Group 2?
And that, Your Honor, we would disagree with. There is no reason for any court to ever determine what the true church is. I know that term has been bandied about. It's been repeated in various opinions. It's certainly made in a number of arguments. We don't care whether the true church is Group 1 or Group 2, or a Catholic church or a Methodist church. Only God can decide what the true church is. The facts that are relevant for the court's opinion are, number one, Mr. Evans and Group 2 always talk about this schism that occurred in 1992. The facts that were before Judge Dobberpool are that in 1995, 3 years later, every member of Hutterville, including Johnny Whip, signed a reaffirmation. We're staying with Group 1. We're not going to Group 2. For the next 16 years, Johnny Whip is a member of the Group 1 church along with everybody at Hutterville. And not until 2008 did he decide that he didn't like it, and he only decided he didn't like it after he was disciplined by the church to which he and every other member belonged, and he was stripped of his authority, and he could no longer act.
Didn't we say, at least in two cases, that that's a religious dispute that we can't get into?
Because you did say that, and that's because Johnny Whip raised a fact issue at the time. He claimed to be president, he claimed to be a member, he claimed it was all part of this schism. Now we depose him in 2012, we depose him in 2013, and what does he admit? Well, I was really a member of Group 1 all along. Not until I was kicked out did I go to Group 2, and not until after I went to Group 2 did I come back and say, okay, now I'm in charge. So we don't have to decide what the true church is. The facts are undisputed. There are two churches. Johnny Whip belongs to one. George Waldner belongs to another. Johnny Whip belonged to George Waldner's church, submitted to its authority, and he was kicked out. Not until after he was kicked out did he come back and say, okay, now I want to take over and I want the property.
And so do we have to reverse Hutterville 1 and 2?
No. Because in both of those cases, this court again got it correct. This court said the church gets to decide who its representatives are. The church gets to decide who speaks for it. The church has decided, and Johnny Whip admitted that the church has decided. This court needs to decide what kind of evidence can be submitted and considered by a court when resolving this issue.
All right. Didn't you just say there are two churches?
There most certainly are.
So we have to decide which of the two churches is in control under your theory. Or we're supposed to decide, just take your word for it, that it's your client's church that is the church that controls?
No, it's not my word, Your Honor. It's the evidence that was in front of Judge Dobberpool, including Johnny Whip's own admissions. Again, Hutterville owned this property since 1983. Johnny Whip was a happy member of Hutterville's church since 1983. In both of this court's prior opinions, Hutterville 1 and Hutterville 2, this court said membership is determined by the local church, not this overriding Hutterite church that Mr. Evans wants to talk about, by the local church. We could look at both of those opinions. In fact, this court previously said in Hutterville 1, the articles and bylaws tie Hutterville membership to the local church. In Hutterville 2, it said, officerships contemplate local church membership. Johnny Whip was a member of the local church. He was kicked out. None of this ever started until after he was kicked out. So yes, he belongs to a different church, but that church has no claim to Hutterville property and never did. So we don't have to decide what the true church is. All we have to do is look at the facts and the chronology, which Judge Dobberpool found to be not in dispute.
Do we have two true churches, both claiming the same property?
I really don't know what's meant by a true church. Again, that's a term that's bandied about.
I know it. We keep seeing it.
Anyone's personal beliefs can constitute a church. And we don't need to decide what the true church is because we have two. One always controlled the property. Johnny Whip left. Now he can't join a new church and come back and say, me and this new church, we want this property. There's no basis under law for something like that. May I get a drink of water? I'm a little bit dry.
Yeah, why don't you bring your water up with you? There.
Thank you.
What about the circuit's observation that this new evidence, the 2012 and 13 evidence,
if we look at,
didn't change anything?
If we look at the Eighth Circuit opinion, they deferred to this court. And Judge Pearsall at the district court level and the Eighth Circuit, they weren't going to wade into this because this court has twice ruled. And they said, if this court has ruled, we're deferring to this court. And now we're before this court. We have new facts. The facts are undisputed, as Judge Dobberpool found. And we think they're controlling.
Would the, in your opinion, would the findings entered by Judge Dobberpool, as Mr. Evans suggests, have res judicata or collateral estoppel effect in future litigation?
They may or they may not, and that's an issue for another day. Our position is that the mere prospect of being estopped in a future proceeding by Mr. Whip's privity with Redacre, his proxy, does not confer standing to appeal. Because Redacre is the plaintiff, and it chose not to appeal. And because it didn't, the judgment against Redacre stands.
You know, Judge Dobberpool decided there wasn't subject matter jurisdiction. Why was it necessary for him to issue findings on the deeds?
Yeah, I believe that's a misstatement of the record by Mr. Evans. Judge Dobberpool decided on the merits that the lease is not invalid. Once he decided that the lease is not invalid, he said, I'm going to dismiss Redacre's complaint because it no longer has a claim. And then subsequent to that, he said, now I'm going to dismiss the counterclaims and the third-party claims because they're moot. There is no damage if the lease is held to be valid. So he never said there was a lack of subject matter jurisdiction. He did point out at one point in the record, he said he's read this court's prior rulings, he's familiar with them, but he never made a ruling that there's a lack of jurisdiction. And if we look at the orders that he entered, none of them say that. So, again, it's our position that Judge Dobberpool had jurisdiction because he had the facts in front of him. The facts are undisputed, and the facts show that. Hutterville has always owned this property. Johnny Whip voluntarily left, and he can't come back now and claim ownership once leaving the church, whether he affiliates with the new Hutterite Church or any other church. This court's prior rulings are very clear. If Johnny Whip is not a member of Hutterville's church, he cannot be a member, officer, or director of Hutterville. The second point is that membership in the local church to which Hutterville belongs is a requirement, and only the church can decide who are and are not its members. Again, very clear, undisputed, Whip was a member from 1983 to 2008 of Hutterville's church. 2008, 55-minister tribunal, he appears before them, they strip him of authority. He gets mad, he quits. Then he comes back months later, armed with lawyers and lawsuits, and claims to be in control. There is no real religious dispute because the undisputed facts have resolved it. Whip admits that he left the church. At that point, that ends the religious dispute. There isn't one. This whole 1992 schism stuff is a red herring. It's repeated frequently. This whole you have to decide the true church stuff is a red herring. The Supreme Court, five different cases going back 70-some years, the most recent of which are the Milivojevic case and the Hosanna-Tabor case, both cited in this court's opinions. The church is entitled to control the selection of who personifies its beliefs and who speaks on its behalf. The church has decided, and the facts before you are not in dispute.
Well, maybe I'm sticking my nose where it doesn't belong here, but
that's one decision, but wasn't there a vote at Hooterville too that members at Hooterville voted to join group two Schmiedeloid? Wasn't that what caused this matter to come to court before us?
I'm actually glad you brought that up, Your Honor. Again, we have to keep the chronology in mind. The vote that you're talking about occurred in 2009. That's a year after Johnny Wipf had left Hutterville's church and had been kicked out. And that vote was taken only by Johnny Wipf and a few of his selected followers. It was not taken by the Waldners. It was not taken by the members of the Group One Church. It was not taken by those then in control by virtue of the fact that they and their church have always owned this property since it was purchased back in 1983. So again, a very clear dividing line. 2008, Johnny Wipf disciplined, and he leaves the church. After that is when these lawsuits started, when he came back armed with lawyers and said, I want to be in control. I want my half. I want to dissolve it. Call me the president. He's still doing that today. Anyone who will listen to him, he will say, I'm the president of Hutterville. The undisputed facts before Judge Dobberpool was he has absolutely no authority. He contributes nothing to the community. He provides no labor. He provides no capital. The Waldner Group, as it always has since 1983, farms that property, and they deposit the proceeds into their communal account for the members of their church. If I could just talk for a moment about Judge Dobberpool's orders. There were three of them that are relevant here. The first, he decided that the leases are not invalid. He had jurisdiction to do that, and we think that order stands. 3 weeks later, after judgment had been entered, attested by the clerk, it was final. 3 weeks later, Johnny Wipf came in and said, Judge, you need to reconsider this because all of these things are happening. Hutterville is exercising authority over its property. Hutterville is merging its corporations. Hutterville's filing deeds. You've got to stop them. None of that was at issue, according to the pleadings. None of it had been put before Judge Dobberpool before judgment had been entered. And whatever Judge Dobberpool expressed an opinion on that occurred after entry of judgment should be stricken. So his orders clarifying the judgment, which in effect modify it, he had no jurisdiction to do that. So we're standing here today asking this court to affirm that part of the judgment that declares the lease invalid because there was jurisdiction and reverse the subsequent orders that were issued after entry of judgment. And I would be happy, I've got a couple of minutes left here if the court has any questions. And I know there's a number of complex issues, both of procedure and First Amendment law and history. And I'd like to use this time to clarify anything I can.
Do I understand your position correctly? What I take away from what I've heard so far is you're not disputing the court decisions that have been made up to this point. You're saying things changed in 2012 and 2013 because of the depositions. Is that a fair?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. What we're saying is that this court got it correct. You've ruled twice now that the First Amendment leaves determination of membership up to an ecclesiastical tribunal. And the question now is, when and how do we ever prove that an ecclesiastical tribunal has ruled? We think we have, because we submitted all of that evidence to Judge Dobberpool. He said he considered it. He said the facts are not in dispute, and he ruled on it. So we think we have met exactly what this court said we should do. And it would be, in our opinion, inconsistent for this court to twice rule that the church gets to decide its own membership and then forever bar us from introducing evidence that the church has decided, which is what I understand to be the appellant's position. We can never put that evidence in front of any court because this court has already heard twice about this dispute. I don't think that's the law.
Okay. I guess there's no other questions from the bench, so thank you very much, Mr. Olson.
And I do appreciate the fact that you allowed me to appear here at Pearl Hawk Beach.
Welcome. Mr. Evans, you have 10 minutes for rebuttal.
Things have changed based upon a 1995 ecclesiastical ruling by the court or by the hierarchy of one of the two groups of the church, the minority group that was voted out in 1992. So things have changed since 2012 because of that. I would comment that we set out in our reply brief that the discipline that supposedly removed Johnny Whiff in January 2008 as a witness brother, as in the record provided by them, said that he would be removed as a witness brother and George Waldner would accept overseers at Hutterville and give up his position as their minister. He refused the religious hierarchy, and therefore Johnny Whiff's witness brother status was never removed because they came as part and parcel of the deal. Just again shows you how intertwined it gets. Things have changed. Let's see what the Eighth Circuit said about that argument. Chief Justice Riley, first of all, says the Waldners have shown that corporate control is the core premise of their RICO causes of action. They then say the Waldners' current arguments contradict the position they took before the South Dakota Supreme Court. Rather than argue the state court did have jurisdiction and decide the governance issue in their favor, as they argue here, the Waldners in state court argued the question was untouchable, could not be resolved by a secular court in either faction's favor. They took that position both in Hutterville 1 and Hutterville 2. Then Justice Riley, or Judge Riley, and this is decided January 2015, just 3 months ago. The Waldners do not contend that these questions over who has control have been resolved since that time. When questioned at oral argument, the Waldners could not identify any intervening ecclesiastical decisions, any, which might have settled the questions.
Were the 2012 and 13 depositions in the record before the circuit?
Yes, they were. There were affidavits, and if you read their briefs, they presented the exact same arguments they're presenting to you. This whole thing about a witness brother and everything, exactly. It's almost cut and paste. And the affidavits that I referred to earlier, sworn affidavits, Levy Waldner, Stephen Sandman, one of their lawyers. Both of them talk about that Johnny Whiff's deposition was taken. They talk about the 1950 Constitution, the 1950 Constitution dividing the church. They talk about group of ministers determined to split off in 1992 and form a new church, ruled that go ahead and talk about the two groups. Whiff affirmed his loyalty to the church, governed by the 1950 Constitution. Prior to 2008, there was no dispute as to who was control. Whiff voluntarily submitted himself to the church discipline meted out by Senior Elder Kleinsasser. Council of 55 Ministers stripped him of his position of witness brother status, all argued in the Eighth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit said none of that makes any difference. It's not new. It was available when you all made your decisions in 2010 and 2012. This all occurred in 2008. I mean, if you're going to have any finality of judgments, there's a lot of cases that I've lost that I'd like to go back and say, I got some new evidence. I found a new witness. I found a new expert that can say something different now. Can I be reheard on that? To me, that argument holds no water because it's not new evidence. It was available to them then, and it doesn't change anything about this being based upon a religious dispute. Were we prejudiced? I think counsel answered that. Were we a aggrieved party? Counsel asked that by, no, don't touch those findings of fact and conclusions of law. And they may be res judicata or collateral estoppel in the future. That, I think, answers that in and of itself. Judge Dauberpool addressed the merits. First of all, Judge Dauberpool at the hearing, transcript 58-59, the court. I'm asking you, I can't figure out who really owns the property. Courts aren't supposed to. The courts is supposed to in its hierarchy, right? Mr. Olson, it's our position that issue has been decided. That issue has been decided. The court. But basically, the courts are supposed to stay away from it. Stay away from it.
All right. Mr. Evans, I'm a little confused on what the hearing was. There were affidavits presented. Once it's contested, that's really not evidence. Was there any evidence? Was there any testimony, anything presented other than affidavits in support of the motions?
All we did is make a motion to dismiss a third-party complaint against us, citing this court's previous holdings. Said that this complaint against us should be dismissed. They, submitted a ton of evidence, affidavits, threw everything in the record, and there was a hearing on our motion to dismiss. They had no motion pending, asked for no affirmative relief, didn't ask for the deeds to be declared invalid. They showed up at the hearing, and Judge Dauberpool, after saying, I don't see how I can address this, he asked, do you want to make a motion to dismiss? Redacre was the plaintiff, Waldner Group was the defendant. Asked Mr. Olson, or whoever was there for him, I wasn't. Do you want to move to dismiss? Yes, we move to dismiss. Court says, granted, dismissed. Looks at us, says, third-party defendant, the original action's been dismissed. You're dismissed, too, because there's no dispute anymore. And things were over. And then came, let's, through the back door, bring in some findings of fact and conclusions of law on the merits.
But what about Mr. Olson's point that he's saying that Dauberpool invited the motion to dismiss because he determined the deeds were invalid and the lease was invalid.
All I'm saying is that if that was the issue there that day, nobody was aware of it. And you don't have a 30-minute hearing on a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction and all of a sudden turn it into a hearing on the merits of the validity of some deeds without live testimony or anything else, number one. And number two, look at his findings of fact and conclusions of law. They'd be much more extensive than three or four findings of fact and three or four conclusions of law submitted by the Waldner side. I mean, if you were really going to hear whether those deeds had merit, you would not do it in such a summary fashion of a half-hour hearing on a motion to dismiss. They were there seeking no affirmative relief, none. They had no motion before the court seeking any affirmative relief and walk out with winning on the merits when you showed up at a hearing asking for no relief. So for all those reasons, unless there's other questions, we would once again ask that the findings and conclusions be vacated. The issues that he's argued here today about there being new and different evidence were all presented to the Eighth Circuit. They decided less than 3 months ago. Nothing's new about this, and even if you look at it all, it doesn't change the nature of this dispute. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. The court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, and we have a rules hearing.